You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
This is John Luke, and I will be reading from the Eagle Tribune, and Susan will be reading from the Lowell Sun. Lab Radio would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. So, the lead story from the Eagle Tribune. Lawrence Mayor sworn in to second term with People First. Lawrence is a city built by immigrants who came with little more than hope and determination, said U.S. Representative Lori Trahan. The revitalization and reimagination of the city is now being led by Mayor Brian DePina, who Trahan praised and applauded as he was inaugurated into his second term in office Monday night. DePina, she said, understands what it means to work hard. That lived experience matters, said Trahan, Democrat of Westford, during an inauguration ceremony in the Performing Arts Center at Lawrence High School. City councilors, school committee, and Greater Lawrence Technical School Committee members from Lawrence were also sworn in. DePina, a native of the Dominican Republic and business owner first elected in November 2022, had 933 more votes than Gonzalez, a city firefighter and community activist, according to the final tally. Gonzalez earned 5,173 votes, 45.4%, to DePina's 6,106 votes, 53.6%, according to the November 4 election results posted on the city's website. Upon his re-election, DePina said he was humbled to be chosen again and would not let the city down. He promised to continue on the progress made during his first term. Speaking in English and then immediately translating his remarks into Spanish, DePina said the people of the city come first. His upcoming term as mayor is another opportunity to move the city forward, he said. He also said in past years, the city's murder rate averaged between 5 and 8 people. Last year, it dropped to 2, although he would like that figure to be 0, he said. Lawrence is a city of history, hard work, and hope built by generations of immigrants, workers, dreamers, and leaders who never gave up in the face of challenges, he said. Today, we honor that legacy by renewing our commitment to a more prosperous, safer, and more united future. In the coming years, we will continue strengthening the education of our youth because they represent the greatest promise of this city. We will keep driving economic development, supporting our small businesses, and creating opportunities for every resident to thrive. We also reaffirm our dedication to public safety, access to essential services, and transparency in every decision we make. He went on to say that Lawrence's progress has always been the result of collective effort, the families who work hard, the municipal employees who serve with dedication, the community organizations that support those who need it most, and every resident who contributes their voice, talent, and commitment. To all of you, I say, my administration will continue to be an open door. I will listen to your concerns, your ideas, your aspirations. To govern is to serve, and serving requires closeness, respect, and collaboration. Also sworn in Monday night were city councilors at large Anna Levy, Selena Reyes, and Giovanni Rodriguez, along with district councilors District A, Franklin Miguel, District B, Rosalie Gonzalez, District C, Gregory Del Rocio, District D, Vivian Marmol, District E, Stephanie Infante, and District F, Mark LaPlante. Rodriguez was re-elected council president in a brief meeting after the inauguration. Serving in this role for a second term is a responsibility I accept with humility and strong commitment to collaboration, transparency, and respect, he said. Lawrence School Committee members Jonathan Guzman, Elia Quinn Gonnell, Jessica Ramirez, Donna Bertolini, Jesus Soriel and Michael Armano, along with Greater Lawrence Technical School Committee members Zila, Disla, Giulio, Magia, and Edison Mercedes were also sworn in. Follow staff reporter Jim Hamaskinsey on Twitter X and Eagle Tribune on Threads by Jim. Susan.
Thank you, John Luke. In the Sun, public facilities, city to buy restroom trailers. Potential uses includes festivals, events, homeless services. In Lowell, street accessible bathrooms could be available for use in Lowell by this summer, in time for visitors to the Lowell Folk Festival, or perhaps even to support the city's homeless population. Tuesday morning, Chief Procurement Officer Michael Vaughn opened 7 vendor bids for 2 Americans with Disabilities Act compliant restroom trailers. The City of Lowell is seeking bids to purchase 2 new portable 4-season ADA restroom trailer plus 4 station, the contract bid said. The 20 to 24 foot trailers will be equipped with an approximately 400-gallon waste tank and an approximately 135-gallon freshwater tank. Each private unisex suite has a flushable toilet, sink vanity, mirror, and ample LED lighting. The exterior of each suite features lighting and handrails for safe entry. The 4-season package ensures that the trailer can withstand extreme winters with temperatures as low as minus 20 degrees, as well as air conditioning for summer use. Neither Department of Public Works Commissioner Paul St. Cyr nor Maura Fitzpatrick, the Director of Homelessness Initiatives, responded to the Sun's request for comment, but Vaughn said the units will be under the control of the DPW. DPW will determine both where to store and where to deploy, he said. No maintenance will be provided by the companies selling the units. Arizona-based Elk Creek Trailers, a professional restroom trailer manufacturer, was the lowest bid at $137,576, from submissions that ranged up to more than $200,000. The company website says its goal is to create a restroom trailer that is durable, easy to maintain, and easy to clean. If the city rolls these units out for use by the homeless community, it will make a significant difference in the quality of life of all residents, both housed and unhoused. Numerous residents and business owners have appeared before the city council to complain about urination and defecation in public places, such as sidewalks and downtown business doorways. Councilors have called the city's Back Central neighborhood a mini Mass and Cass, referring to the area of Boston plagued by the same homeless, drug, and crime crisis that has been growing for several years in Lowell's poorest neighborhood. Currently, there are limited publicly accessible restrooms for use by the homeless population. During the day, various locations such as City Hall and the Pollard Memorial Library on Merrimack Street and the Gallagher Terminal by South Common Park off Thorndike Street all offer public restrooms. Most private businesses restrict bathroom use to paying customers. The Day Center at Elliott Church on Summer Street in Lowell's Back Central neighborhood addresses the needs of the city's homeless population, including food, medical support, and an accessible bathroom. The church runs the day center Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., and St. Paul's Soup Kitchen takes over this space from 3 to 6 p.m. for dinner service. Those services are not available nights or weekends. During its operating hours, the day center's single ADA-compliant restroom in the building's fellowship hall serves a daily population of almost 200 people, said Charlie Ott, the director of operations for the Elliott Church Day Center. Access to the newly renovated bathroom is monitored by a day center employee. A sign on the door notes that only one person at a time is allowed. There is a 5-minute time limit, and no coats, backpacks, or bags are allowed in the room. Every little bit helps, Ott said, referencing the potential for an additional city-provided sanitation system for the homeless population. A Cambodian-American man who declined to give his name said Tuesday he had been on the streets since the New Hampshire company he worked for closed. He called a bathroom trailer for use by homeless people a good idea. "I'm stuck out here," he said. "I usually use the bathroom at the Elliott Church. The bathroom inside is busy." Green plastic netting surrounded the small front lawn to the church entrance facing Summer Street to prevent tenting and toileting on the property. The green space became a de facto encampment following the city's clearing of South Common Park last fall. Down on Appleton Street, the newly opened Project Compass said their bathroom facilities are only available to clients registered with their program services. A small driveway adjacent to the building had been used as an outdoor toilet prior to the nonprofit purchasing the building. Founder and board chair Dave Aldrich said Tuesday, "The organization has since fenced off access to that area and will convert it into a garden for use by its staff and clients." The number of homeless people sleeping in Lowell was 25 in 2016. 9 years later, the point-in-time count, an annual exercise mandated by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, recorded 250 homeless people in the city. 50 were unsheltered and living outdoors. During the winter, homeless people are less visible on the streets thanks to Winter Protocol, which began on November 17. The annual 4-month program expands the number of hotel and emergency shelter beds and allows for clients to stay indoors at the Lowell Transitional Living Center during the day. Vaughn said the city reviews the lowest proposal first to determine whether they are qualified bidder. "Once that's done, we'll issue a request to the law department to make a contract with the low bidder, and they'll have to fill out the contract," Vaughn said. "Once the contract is fully executed, a purchase order will be issued, and then they'll be able to manufacture the units. Delivery is required no later than June 30. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. North Andover. Merrimack Valley Venezuelans jumped for joy Saturday when the startling news broke that U.S. forces had plucked Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife from their Caracas compound. "My reaction was jumping," said Cinzina Talsi of Lawrence, a U.S. resident of 25 years who has family living in Venezuela and in hardship. Talsi and two other Valley Venezuelans said they were elated that Maduro has been removed to New York City, where he and his wife, Celia Flores, face federal charges, including those for drug trafficking. But another shoe must drop for real change to take place in their native country. "Getting, quote, Maduro out is not going to do anything, because you still have that whole group of people that are controlling all this mafia stuff," said Renta Berthold de Bustard, who lives in Andover. Bustard, Talsi, and professional musician Eduardo Gomez, who lives in Lowell and plays in the North Andover-based Merrimack Valley Philharmonic Orchestra, said a contingent of Venezuelan political officials known as Chavismo and their supporters in the military must be removed for the suffering of Venezuelan citizens to end. Those include Delcy Rodriguez, the former vice president and current president, as well as Diosdado Celio and Jorge Rodriguez. Chavismo were and remain loyal to the ideas of populist leader Hugo Chavez, elected in 1999 and who held on to power until 2013 when he died from cancer and was succeeded by Maduro. Economic conditions in Venezuela deteriorated under Chavez and then Maduro to the point where now some 8 million Venezuelans have fled the country as refugees and migrants living in Colombia and Peru and the United States. This is a country with the largest amount of oil reserves, 303 billion barrels. Life has become too hard in the country, leading to widespread hunger. No food, no medicine, Gomez said. People critical of Maduro, including supporters of exiled opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, were jailed and tortured, some of them killed. He has over 1,000 people in prison who haven't done anything, Bustard said. Some died already, and they are being tortured, and it's horrible. While many Americans and leaders in Latin America have been highly critical of President Donald Trump's move to order the military to enter a foreign country and remove its leaders, Bustard, Talsi, and Gomez are focused on the possibility of life improving for Venezuelans. Gomez, a flutist, and his wife, Vanessa Sanchez, expect more action against the current Venezuelan leadership to come from the Trump administration. It doesn't make sense that the U.S. would remove Maduro and leave his power base in charge of the country, he said. Maduro was the first step, you know. It is the first step, Sanchez said. I think that another step, there was going to be another attack from the United States. Bustard knows firsthand what it was like to lose a livelihood under the rule of Hugo Chavez. In 2012, Chavez took over her company and those of other business people, nationalizing private businesses. He was the one who killed the textile industry, Bustard said, killed my factory. Bustard was married to a U.S. service member and her two children, adults now, are U.S. citizens. In 2014, a year after her husband's death, she fended off two attackers and a violent home invasion in Caracas, and her children urged her to come to this country for her safety. Trelsey, who works for nonprofits, moved to the United States from Venezuela 25 years ago. She was 33 years old and also had two grown children, a son who was a U.S. Army veteran and a police officer in Houston, Texas, and a daughter who lives in Waltham. Trelsey has worked for nonprofits, currently presenting seminars on home ownership. Susan.
Thank you, John Luke. In The Sun, Capitol Riot Anniversary, An Assault on American Democracy. Mass lawmakers reflect on January 6, 5 years later. In Lowell, 5 years after a mob of supporters of President Donald Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol building on January 6, 2021, U.S. Rep. Lori Trahan often thinks about her own experience that day when she sheltered in place with two staffers in her office. Trahan, having just begun her second term in Congress, was at the Capitol that day for the vote to certify the election for now former President Joe Biden, who had won the 2020 general election despite repeated claims by Trump that the election had been rigged against him. When the crowd became violent and started to enter the Capitol building, Trahan and her staffer stayed in her office while dozens of her colleagues fled the Capitol chambers to safe holding rooms as the crowd closed in. 5 years on and 1 year into a second Trump administration, Trahan said, beyond her own experience, she often thinks of that day in the context of the different reactions Americans had to it. It was a representation of how divided our country was, how people got their information, how the president claimed a stolen election, and how that was kind of able to take hold, Trahan said, while sitting down with The Sun in her Lowell office Tuesday morning. When I think of my experience that day, it never leaves you. It was a horrible day in history. It was a horrible day for my family. It was a horrible day for my colleagues. It was just a horrible day for our country. Over time, Trahan said she does not want history to forget what happened. I want to get at the underlying issues, whether it is the divisiveness the spread of misinformation to cause people who live in the same community to think wildly differently about things that really are factual, said Trahan. I walk into the Capitol every single day and see the same two Capitol police officers. I think about what they went through that day. I think about the obligation we have to them to not let history whitewash what happened that day. And I think about the obligation to make sure an event like that never happens again. U.S. Rep. Seth Moulton was also there that day and recalled to the Boston Herald at the one-year anniversary how he saw Capitol Police gathering for the planned protest by Trump supporters, but was struck by how few officers there were. When the building was being attacked, Moulton was among those who found themselves in a holding room, debating over whether to return to the chambers to finish the certification vote. Now in 2026, Moulton said the undermining of the democratic process continues to this day. 5 years ago, Donald Trump tried to overturn the results of a free and fair election by inciting the violence that led to the January 6th insurrection. Moulton said in a post on Blue Sky Tuesday, "Today, his attacks and our democracy continue. We must learn from that day and do everything we can to ensure it never repeats." In his own statement on the anniversary, U.S. Rep. Jim McGovern recalled Trump's own words to the crowd from that day. 5 years ago today, Trump told a MAGA mob to go to the Capitol and fight like hell. They beat up cops and desecrated our history. He enlisted fraudulent electors and they forged documents to stay in power, despite losing, McGovern said in a post on Facebook Tuesday. Then he pardoned everyone involved, including criminals he let out, who were then convicted of new crimes such as rape, murder, and possession of child pornography. Right-wing media and the billionaire Epstein class they serve want to rewrite history about what happened. Don't let them. In a statement Monday, U.S. Senator Ed Markey called those who stormed the Capitol a vicious and violent mob, which had a goal of overturning the results of the 2020 election. Fortunately, Trump and his gang of bigoted, violent extremists failed in their mission to undermine our democracy that day. But Trump continues to bear direct responsibility for this disgraceful, dangerous attack, which forever scarred our political system and our nation, said Markey. We cannot and must not forget what happened on January 6, 2021, and the enduring consequences of that terrible day. Trump's MAGA mob attacked the brave officers of the Capitol Police with metal pipes, baseball bats, and chemical sprays, resulting in the death of several officers and injuries to more than 140 members of law enforcement. Markey noted Trump's pardon for hundreds of the January 6 rioters on the first day of his second term last year. Trump and his supporters continue to rewrite the truth of that tragic day, whitewashing the violence of the riot and hailing those who carried Confederate flags and symbols of white supremacy through the halls of the Capitol as patriots, said Markey. But true American patriots stand up for democracy. True American patriots don't bend the knee to wannabe kings. Every American must denounce the actions of those who chose to subvert our Constitution on January 6th and condemn those who continue to side with lawlessness and authoritarianism over the basic principles of American democracy. Equality, freedom, and the peaceful transfer of power. Our future depends on it. In a post on Blue Sky, U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren called the January 6th riot and Trump's pardoning of the rioters, an assault on American democracy. In a separate post, Warren pointed to the investigation conducted by special counsel Jack Smith into the riot and Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election. That investigation ended with the dismissal of the charges against Trump in the wake of his victory in 2024. But Smith has since maintained that Trump would have been found guilty if the charges had been allowed to move forward. Jack Smith testified to Congress he had proof beyond a reasonable doubt that President Trump engaged in a criminal scheme to overturn the results of the 2020 election. In other words, he could prove in court that Trump attempted a coup, said Warren. Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. Pretty scary stuff. Okay, Eagle Tribune again. First, eggs and issues of 2026 on Friday by Jimmy Costa. Haverhill. The Greater Haverhill Chamber of Commerce will host this month's Eggs and Issues meeting from 8:30 to 9 a.m. on Friday, January 9th at the Hampton Inn, 106 Bank Road. The session brings local people together with the local business community for conversations around the challenges and opportunities faced by the Merrimack Valley. State Rep. Andy Vargas, Democrat of Haverhill, will speak at the event. Breakfast is provided at Eggs and Issues as well. Networking and breakfast begin at 8:30 a.m. and the start of the program is at 9 a.m. Admission is $15 for members and $26 for non-members. Folks can register at haverhillchamber.com. Email President Katie Cook with any questions at Katie, and that's spelled K-A-T-I-E, at haverhillchamber.com. Essex Heritage announces 2026 Partnership Grant Program. Essex Heritage has announced the start of its 28th annual partnership grant cycle for 2026 on Monday. Grants are $2,000 reimbursed upon completion of the project and require a $4,000 minimum total project cost. Applications may be submitted any time between now and Monday, February 16th. Nonprofit organizations located in Essex County and municipal entities affiliated with one of the county's 34 communities are eligible to apply. The application process should take less than an hour to complete. Grants are available in four categories: education, create or further develop education opportunities for youth, interpretation, increase awareness for understanding of the region's cultural heritage, preservation, preserve or enhance historic structures, landscapes, and cultural resources, accessibility, provide equitable experiences for residents and visitors to the Essex National Heritage Area. Since 2026 marks the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, projects specifically focusing on Essex County connections with the Revolution 250 will be given special consideration. Over the next year, I am excited to partner with 12 grant recipients in the development and implementation of a broad range of educational, interpretive, accessibility, and preservation projects throughout Boston's North Shore and the Merrimack Valley, particularly those focusing on Essex County's revolutionary history, said Grants Program Manager Charles Smith. The Essex Heritage Partnership Grant Program is a matching grant program that aims to support the stewardship activities of communities and organizations that share Essex Heritage's mission to preserve and enhance the historic, cultural, and natural resources of the Essex National Heritage Area. The 27-year-old program has invested more than $1.6 million in support of the region's heritage. For more information, visit essexheritage.org/programs/partnerships-grants. Or, much easier, call 978-740-0444. Susan.
Thank you, Jean-Luc. Back to the Sun. Your tax dollars at work. Governor's office admits error in Cook pay. Will seek to claw back cash paid to alleged Coke dealer. The Boston Herald. Governor Maura Healey's administration is racing to grab back some of the cash paid to an alleged cocaine trafficker in a year full of high salaries collected by state employees who were fired, indicted, or accused of poor performance. It's all part of the Herald's Your Tax Dollars at Work analysis that on Monday night had the governor's office admitting they screwed up with former top aide Lamar Cook. Lamar Cook. Cook, the governor's ex-Western Massachusetts deputy director, was arrested in October after state police intercepted 21 kilograms of cocaine being shipped to the Springfield State office, where he worked. He had since been fired from his job after pleading not guilty, but he was paid $130,227 last year, records show. That was off a base salary of $98,789 and a buyout that totaled $31,439. The Healey's administration and finance office said Monday night it was an error to pay Cook unused vacation pay after the Herald saw an explanation. The governor's office is scrambling to get the money back, a spokesman added. Taxpayer dollars should never go to an individual who engaged in this type of outrageous criminal activity. This payment was erroneously made, and we have taken action to get it back, an ANF spokesman added. The spokesman, Matt Murphy, added the agency will take legal actions as necessary. Monica Tibbetts-Nutt, the ousted MassDOT Secretary of Transportation, took home $171,938 in 2025, records show. She did not cash in any unused time, but did leave money on the table. Her annual rate is listed at $206,496. Healey's office made the announcement that MBTA Chief Phil Eng was taking over in October. Tibbetts-Nutt was allowed to stay on until the end of the year in an advisory capacity. Eng was paid his MBTA base salary of $509,114. He did receive a $30,000 bump for a category listed on the state payroll as A14, an object code used for recording stipends, bonus pay, and awards. Still, Eng picked up the pieces when Tibbetts-Nutt was shown the door. State Rep. Chris Flanagan. Flanagan was paid $111,565 last year. He was arrested in April on federal charges that he stole tens of thousands of dollars from a trade association he worked for, covered up the thefts, and then used the money to pay personal bills and fund his campaign for elected office. He has pleaded not guilty. His base pay as a state representative is the uniform, $81,657, but he too benefited from an A14 bump of $29,908 for added responsibilities in the state legislature. Michael Proctor, the worst of the Karen Reed state police investigators, who was fired from his job over that case, was paid a measly $3,617 last year. That was all from a buyout of unused sick and vacation days. He had long been suspended from his six-figure job without pay. Sergeant Yuri Bukenik, Proctor's boss in the state police, earned $223,342 last year. Bukenik is now on a temporary duty assignment at the Division of Standards and Training in the Framingham headquarters, the MSP announced in July. That didn't stop him from logging $37,175 in overtime and $54,141 in a category labeled A20 used for police detail pay. Norfolk DA Michael Morrissey, the embattled district attorney, was paid $223,442 and is up for re-election. his work was tied to the dismal performance of his lead state police investigators in the Karen Reed case. He is also tied to the lack of prosecution in the death of Sandra Birchmore, a 23-year-old Canton resident who federal authorities say was strangled to death in 2021 by a Staunton cop while pregnant. Morrissey, 70, has yet to announce whether he intends to run for a fifth four-year term in November's election. He has served as Norfolk County's lead prosecutor since being elected in 2010. Opponents are lining up for his job. Judge Shelley Joseph, the judge earned $207,855 this past year. This as a Commission on Judicial Conduct hearing officer ruled in November that she should receive a public reprimand for impropriety for allowing an illegal immigrant to slip past ICE officers in a Newton court in 2018. She now serves in the Boston Municipal Court. Judge Beverly Canone, the Norfolk Superior Court judge, was tossed into the Karen Reed storm for both the first and second trials. Like Joseph, she was paid a judge's base pay of $207,855. Send your tips and questions to joed@bostonherald.com as we work on this 19th annual Your Tax Dollars at Work rolling report. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. Maybe we all should get those kind of jobs with that kind of pay. Okay, Plastow selectmen advance warrant articles that could push budget near $14.7 million. Plastow, Board of Selectmen Monday night moved forward several warrant articles that, if approved by voters in March, would add hundreds of thousands of dollars to the budget. The General Operating Fund, put forward at $14.1 million, could increase to as high as $14.7 million if all monetary warrant articles pass, including those offset by existing reserve funds. If the operating budget fails, it will default to $13.9 million, $600,000 more than last year's $13.3 million budget. In addition to the operating budget, voters will also be asked to consider the water budget, 13 monetary articles, the auction of two municipal vehicles, and a fee change. All but one article received the support of the Board of Selectmen, asking residents to raise and appropriate $100,000 for mowing and upkeep along Route 125. Selectmen argued the town should not be responsible for maintaining state property, citing the state's failure to keep up with the landscaping along the Route 125 corridor. However, board members said the final decision should rest with voters and opted to keep the warrant article on the ballot. Other warrant articles include the Water Department's $512,000 water budget funded by the Water Enterprise Fund with no impact on taxpayers raised, somehow mushed together in all words, I don't know if that matters, an appropriate $40,300 to pay for the first year of a three-year Teamster contract move, $85,000 from the unassigned fund balance to the contingency fund to pay for any unexpected expenses not included in the budget, like repairs, failures in the system, or for any CIP project deposits, $100,000 into the Highway Department Equipment Expendable Trust Fund for special purchase deposit, $60,000 into the Building Expendable Trust Fund to replace the ramp in front of Town Hall, deposit $55,000 into the Library Capital Reserve Fund, deposit $250,000 into the Revaluation Capital Reserve Fund to help level fund this year's revaluation. Deposit $140,000 into the Fire Department Apparatus Capital Reserve Fund. Deposit $30,000 into the Fire Department Equipment Capital Reserve Fund to pay for general equipment replacement like hoses. Deposit $30,000 into the Fire Department Radio Capital Reserve Fund for the purchase of one radio, deposit $80,000 into the Public Safety Communications Capital Reserve Fund, deposit $80,000 into the Police Vehicle Capital Reserve Fund to cover the cost of replacing one vehicle, deposit $25,000 into the cemetery special maintenance expendable trust fund to replace headstones that have aged, cracked, or fallen over, raise approximately $75,000 for the police department to hire one traffic enforcement officer, authorize the town clerk to collect an additional fee of $5 per motor vehicle registration effective April 1 for the purpose of creating a municipal transportation improvement fund for sidewalk replacements, line striping, or matching funds for state projects. Allow the town to auction two police vehicles. Because 2026 is a reevaluation year required by state law every 5 years, the assessing department put in a request for $250,000 to pay for the reevaluation, bringing the budget up from $130,000 last year to $349,000 this year. Over the last several years, the town has been unsuccessful in raising funds from voters, approving only $35,000 to help offset the costs. The rest will now be raised by taxes. Residents will also vote to elect residents to town and school boards and committees. Voting will take place from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. on March 10th at the Plastile Fish and Game Club, 18 May Ray Ave. Susan.
Thank you, Jean-Luc. Back to the Sun in Worcester. Sex slave sues hotel chain. Lawsuit claims signs of widespread and ongoing sex trafficking at its hotel. Boston Herald. A woman who is reportedly a sex slave in a hotel is suing one of the largest hotel franchisers in the world, saying the chain should have stopped the rampant sex trafficking. RB, who calls herself a survivor of sex trafficking, has filed a civil lawsuit in Massachusetts federal court against Choice Hotels International. She's seeking compensation after she was reportedly sex trafficked at Choice Hotels Quality Inn and Suites in Worcester for 1 to 2 years between January 2016 and December 2017. RB was forced to be a sex slave in a sex trafficking venture between the harboring defendants and her traffickers at the Quality Inn. Her Boston lawyer wrote in the suit, for up to 20 days at a time, RB was repeatedly trafficked for sex through coercion, threats, and force at the Quality Inn by members of the Kilby Street Gang, she claims in the lawsuit. RB was reportedly forced to have sex with multiple Johns every day that she trafficked at the Quality Inn. Every time she stayed at the hotel, a minimum of 5 Johns came through the hotel to purchase sex. RB says she was sexually assaulted hundreds of times as part of her sexual servitude at the hotel. She's arguing that the Quality Inn and Choice Hotels knew or should have known that sex trafficking was going on and that the chain financially benefited from it. The harboring defendants derived financial benefit from facilitating sex trafficking by providing venues where traffickers could exploit victims, including victims such as RB with minimal risk of detection or interruption, her attorney wrote. The defendants continued supporting the traffickers despite evident and apparent signs of widespread and ongoing sex trafficking at its hotel and specifically at the Quality Inn. The lawyer added, the harboring defendants were, therefore, knowingly receiving a benefit from participation in a venture that defendants knew or should have known was engaged in sex trafficking. RB claimed that she encountered the same hotel staff multiple times at the Quality Inn. The staff members became familiar with RB and her traffickers due to their repeated presence, extended stays, frequent room changes, and constant stream of male visitors, she added. The harboring defendant's staff saw signs of RB's and other trafficked women's abuse perpetrated by their traffickers, including bruising and physical and verbal abuse occurring in public areas of the Quality Inn property, her lawyer wrote. When most of the Kilby gang members operating out of the Quality Inn were arrested in late 2016, other perpetrators allegedly took over the area and continued to traffic RB and other women at the Quality Inn. RB's traffickers frequently rented rooms at the Choice Quality Inn because their rooms provided convenient, anonymous, and relatively central locations for Johns that would pay to engage in sex with RB. Her lawsuit reads, "The relationship between the traffickers and the harboring defendants and the Quality Inn was continuous and obvious, and the harboring defendants knew or should have known about it," the suit states. RB's traffickers reportedly connected with Johns by posting ads on Craigslist and Backpage. The traffickers allegedly posted many of these ads and had conversations with Johns while connected to Choice's managed Wi-Fi at the Quality Inn. On multiple occasions, RB said she was subjected to verbal and physical abuse. The loud, abusive, destructive noise was never investigated by hotel staff, and law enforcement was never notified, the lawsuit reads. The harboring defendants maintained and had access to security camera footage documenting the constant stream of buyers from cameras placed throughout the hotel and would have seen the trafficking of RB if it had followed any reasonable measure to ensure guest safety at the Quality Inn. The harboring defendants further maintained reservation systems, guest complaint databases, and Wi-Fi records that documented unusually high foot traffic, short-term male visitors, and repeated disturbances associated with RB's trafficking, the suit states. Despite access to this information, defendants took no corrective action and continued profiting from the venture. Choice Hotels did not immediately respond to comment about the lawsuit. Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. Pretty distressing stuff. Their view, Venezuela's future unclear after Maduro's arrest. This is an opinion piece coming from the Miami Herald. What happens now? Will democracy really prevail in Venezuela? In Doral on Saturday, decades of pent-up fear and frustration spilled onto the streets. The news that the United States had captured, the word used by President Donald Trump, Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro and his wife during the night after a month-long pressure campaign by the U.S. caused a burst of pre-dawn dancing and flag-waving and shouts of "Si, se puedo," yes, we did it. Maduro, who destabilized Venezuela, stealing an election, ruining its economy, and forcing millions to migrate to the U.S. and other countries. But a Venezuela without Maduro is not a guarantee for democracy. The U.S. has learned this lesson after decades of interfering in other countries' affairs and helping oust its leaders, from Iraq to Chile. Will Venezuela be different? The prospect of a Venezuela no longer under the thumb of Maduro's authoritative regime, a narco-terrorist enterprise, as the U.S. Justice Department called it, is obviously cause for an enormous joy. Nowhere is this truer than here in Miami, especially in Doralzuela. But since Venezuela run by U.S., which Trump said during a rambling speech on Saturday will happen until a transition can take place, is a risky proposition. Trump did not rule out keeping troops in the country, saying, "We're not afraid of it." Is Trump's true interest to see democracy in Venezuela and to install a new leader who's more friendly to the U.S. and its interests in the nation's oil reserves? Regardless, in Miami, where so many of our neighbors and friends have found refuge from oppressive governments, this movement carries enormous resistance. The suffering in Venezuela has gone on for so long, starting with Hugo Chavez in 1999 and followed by Maduro, who has stayed in power since 2013. In 2020, the U.S. indicted Maduro and other charges of drug trafficking and money laundering. but this is also Washington's most direct intervention in Latin America since the Panama invasion of 1989 that removed Manuel Noriega. It will certainly and rightfully receive a mixed reaction abroad. America has a long history of propping up authoritarian regimes in Latin America. There are obvious concerns that the U.S. is motivated by a hunger for the massive oil reserves of Venezuela. Another fear is that this action, ostensibly based on a war on drugs, could embolden countries like China or Russia to go after their neighbors. On Saturday, it was clear where Miami's Republican members of Congress fell. U.S. Representative Carlos Jimenez compared the action in Venezuela to the fall of the Berlin Wall. U.S. Representative Mario Diaz-Balart said the Maduro regime has represented an unprecedented national security threat. Democrats, on the other hand, raised concerns about Trump bypassing Congress. Congress must be properly informed and hold hearings on this invasion, U.S. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Broward County wrote on X. We agree. No doubt, Secretary of State Marco Rubio played a decisive role in the drive to rid Venezuela of Maduro. He has consistently pushed for an action against the Venezuelan leader. The spotlight will once again be on Miami's Rubio. Will Edmundo Gonzalez, the candidate backed by the opposition leader Maria Corina Machado in the 2024 elections, take office? With Trump vowing to greater involvement by the U.S. and the Venezuelan people must be allowed to control their own fate. And what will happen with immigration? People may begin to return to Venezuela, or perhaps the instability will fuel more desire to leave if the rebuilding process is too shaky. Many Venezuelans, while rejoicing the removal of Maduro, are wary of prolonged U.S. influence in their country. Many Americans, too, don't want to see the U.S. involved overseas. That's something Trump campaigned on. It doesn't help that there are big questions in the U.S. about the legality of the boat strikes that the U.S. has been conducting on the waters off Venezuela, and Congress has not authorized a war on Venezuela. Supposedly, this is all really about drugs. Trump's critics, though, argue that his focus on Venezuela is misguided because most of the fentanyl that has claimed many American lives enters the U.S. from Mexico. A president whose approval ratings are lower than ever is leading the U.S. down a path that risks destabilizing an entire region. We are not wasting tears on Maduro, but there is a difficult path ahead. Susan.
Thank you, John Luke. Back to the Sun. Economy. Back on the menu. Harbor shellfish, harvest safe to eat. The Boston Herald, love that clean water. For the first time in 100 years, commercial and recreational shellfishers will be allowed to direct harvest shellfish in Boston Harbor, according to the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, thanks largely to the multi-billion dollar cleanup of Boston Harbor. Water quality has improved enough to reclassify certain areas of the harbor to conditionally approved, allowing shellfishing for direct human consumption, said Wayne Castingway, the Gloucester Regional Shellfish Supervisor. These areas include some of the most productive shellfish habitats in the Bay State, in parts of Winthrop, Hingham, and Hull. Not only will this be a tremendous boon to residents of the three towns, but also to other Massachusetts residents interested in recreational shellfishing, Castingway added. Some of these areas have been harvested over the years on a limited basis, but the soft-shelled clams had to be sent to the Division of Marine Fisheries Shellfish Depuration Plant in Newburyport, where the clams were purified before they could go to market. While the depuration process makes shellfish safe to eat, it's expensive, labor-intensive, and is limited to a few specially trained and certified commercial harvesters. As such, most residents of the Commonwealth cannot benefit from this fishery, the Gloucester Regional Shellfish Supervisor said. Reclassification in Boston Harbor will eliminate the need for this highly regulated and controlled process and allow this bountiful public resource to benefit the general public. In 1925, a national typhoid epidemic caused by the consumption of contaminated oysters led to the closure of almost all of Boston Harbor to shellfishing. While the state has ruled that large areas of the outer harbor are clean enough to be reclassified for direct harvest, the actual timing of the reopening requires more collaboration with the local cities and towns. As a home rule state, Massachusetts cedes management of shellfishing in clean waters to the local cities and towns. Because Winthrop, Hingham, and Hull have no history of managing shellfisheries, they need to take some other steps before they can allow shellfishing. First, a local management plan must be developed to specify how the fishery will be managed sustainably. Second, they need to establish enforceable rules and regulations, as well as a local permitting system. Third, a local shellfish constable must be hired and trained to oversee all aspects of the fishery. Also, the areas will be subject to closures following rainfall, sewage spills, and other unforeseen events that can negatively affect water quality. As a result, the towns will need to develop a conditional area management plan with the state. To help the towns develop these new procedures, DMF Shellfish Program staff have already met with officials from Winthrop, Hingham, and Hull. These areas are expected to begin opening for shellfish harvesting this year. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. I guess we have time for a quickie before our break. 5 hours ago, opinion piece letter. Latest deadly ploy for distraction is working. Staff writer. To the editor, hey, you have to hand it to the distractor-in-chief and his minions. The illegal attack on Venezuela sucks up all the media oxygen and focuses attention away from both the failure to release all of the Epstein files and the highly damaging testimony of Special Counsel Jack Smith. The partial Epstein files dump was heavily redacted to protect the rich and powerful every stripe and position, especially number 47, revealing little that was not already known. And House Judiciary Committee's release on New Year's Eve of Jack Smith's testimony was timed so that nobody would be listening. That testimony highlighted Trump's central role in inciting the January 9, 2021 insurrection and also implicates Republicans, many still in Congress, in the widely debunked 2020 election denial conspiracy. In short, it's Wag the Dog. Interesting movie, but unfortunately, Epstein, January 6th, Venezuela, on and on, are not a movie. P.S. Knock on bonuses, distraction from the abandonment of Ukraine, and complicity in the Palestinian genocide. What a wonderful start to the new year. When Americans wake up from their holiday and post-holiday celebrations, will they realize that they've been taken for suckers and conned again? Will they do anything about it? Want to bet? Greg Davis from Salem. Okay, it is time for our mid-show break, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
Through an emergency exit. I never wanted to do it in an auditorium. I wanted to do it in a regular room, he said. I had plenty of opportunities, especially this semester. I had plenty of opportunities, but I always chickened out. Students were shot at random. He insisted he's not mentally ill. He said he didn't want to be famous and that the video wasn't a manifesto. Neves Valente said his only objective was to leave more or less on his own terms and to ensure he wouldn't be the one who ended up suffering the most from all this. No, that cannot happen. So if you don't like it, tough luck, he said. Neves Valente called his execution of the murders a little incompetent, but at least something was done, he said. Neves Valente wounded 9 people and killed 2 students, sophomore Ella Cook, 19, and 18-year-old freshman Mohammad Aziz Umerzokov. 2 days later, authorities say Neves Valente fatally shot Loriero. Valente and Loriero attended the same academic program at a university in Portugal between 1995 and 2000. Loriero graduated from the physics program at Instituto Superior Técnico, Portugal's premier engineering school in 2000, according to his MIT faculty page. The same year, Neves Valente was let go from her position at the Lisbon University, according to an archive of a termination notice from the school's then president in February 2000. In the recording, he said he'd had the storage space where his body was found for about 3 years. Neves Valente mentioned his confrontation with the witness at Brown University and that ultimately led to his identification days later. According to police, a witness had several encounters with Neves Valente before the attack at Brown. As police posted images of the person of interest, the witness began posting on the social media forum Reddit that he recognized the person and theorized that police should look into possibly a rental gray Nissan. Reddit users urged him to inform the FBI, and the witness said he did. Up until that point, the police affidavit says officials had not connected a vehicle to the possible shooter. "I actually was confronted," Neves Valente said about the shooting at Brown, adding that the witness had seen his license plate. "I honestly never thought it would take them so long to find me," he said. He said he had no hatred or love for the United States, where he first arrived around 25 years ago to study physics at Brown's graduate program before leaving in the spring of 2001. Neves Valente had studied at Brown on a student visa. He eventually obtained legal permanent residence status in September 2017. His last known residence was in Miami. "It's the same thing with Portugal and most of the places where I have been," he said, adding later that, "I've been here without caring for a very long time." Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. Back to the Eagle Tribune. Petitioners want building ban on Wyndham ballot. Article by whatever by Jamie Costa. Wyndham, a citizen's petition filed by a planning board member, seeks voter approval to halt residential and mixed-use development after the board opted not to advance its own version of a growth management ordinance. The petition, filed by Matt Rounds, asks voters in March to adopt a growth management ordinance that would pause development for an undetermined period, providing relief to the school district amid capacity concerns. The citizens' petition, including the proposed growth management ordinance, will be discussed at a public hearing on January 7th. I guess that's today. All right. Rounds gathered 60 signatures before submitting its petition to the town on December 10th, hours before the planning board scheduled workshop to discuss its own draft ordinance. Signatories included board members Jack Gattanella, Pale Balada, Derek Monson, and Roger Hohenberger. Not all town officials are on board. There was a several months long process to define an ordinance, taking input from other planning board members, the public, and legal counsel, and then what that input doesn't go to the way you like it, you submit a citizen's position, doing the same, ignoring a good portion of that input, said Selectman Heath Partington in response to the citizen's petition. Rounds' version of the ordinance, which shares language with the board's draft, seeks to regulate the timing of residential development to ensure K-8 educational facilities remain adequate and below functional capacity, according to data included in the ordinance. Most grades are over or nearly recommended functional capacity and student-to-teacher ratios. The ordinance would apply to all residential development that proposes dwelling units, including subdivisions, site plans, multifamily or mixed-use developments, and conversions to year-round residential use. It would not apply to certain workforce housing, age-restricted housing, renovations or approved but unbuilt units. As a conservative, I cannot sit back and watch our taxes climb higher year after year while the town continues to approve unchecked growth without any financial accountability, said resident Alex Inglis in support of the citizens' petition. Families in Windham are already stretched thin, and the idea of adding more tax burden, especially when developers are paying next to nothing, is absolutely unacceptable. Inglis said he believes the petition should go before voters in March. Not having it go to warrant would be nothing more than the government shutting the people out of their own future, he said. If adopted, the ordinance would require the planning board to update the town's master plan and capital improvement plan within 1 year to coordinate future K-8 facility planning. The ordinance would then be reviewed every 5 years. At its December 10 meeting, a majority of the board concluded its own version of the growth management ordinance, drafted as an alternative to a proposed moratorium, was not legally sound or ready for the March ballot. We need to spend this next year coming up with a study for growth management, Balia said. We need to look at when was the highest growth burst for the town and how it was handled, and come up with how many subdivisions we should allow in a year and how many permits should be issued in a year. Restricting all of this just on school numbers is not doing justice. Balia added that limiting the analysis to the school district alone would be a disservice, noting that the population growth also affects municipal services like public safety, water and sewer systems, and road maintenance. The growth management ordinance filed by Rounds focuses on school capacity, particularly at the Golden Brook School, which is just 45 students from reaching structural capacity. Data generated using a formula from the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development indicates the district cannot afford to absorb even one additional student. The school district has to take all children that come in, Rounds said. Tomorrow, if 50 students showed up on the steps of the GBS, they would have to take them. But when the school was at double capacity, we had kids with their homerooms and hallways that were so crowded. Rounds argued that the impact on the school district was more urgent than the effect on other municipal services. Certain members of the planning board are dragging their feet. When my child is learning in a hallway, lawsuits from developers will be the least of your worries, said Johnny Kincaid. Hollenberger remained reluctant to move forward with the board's version of the ordinance, highlighting concerns raised by town attorney Bernie Campbell and data from a third-party study conducted by a professional planner. The Forgey study brought up an important point, Hollenberger said. In the last 5 years, we've built 500 houses, but our student population went down. To make direct correlation between new housing starts and student population increases needs a lot of study and documentation. Although Hohenberger and Balia opposed advancing the board's ordinance, both expressed support for Rounds' citizens' petition, which could reduce the town's risk of potential lawsuits. No one is disagreeing with the statement, the direction, the methodology, the need for this, said Vice Chair Tom Early, but we want a defensible source of documentation to back this up. We need to organize them and be able to discuss them as a group if we're serious about getting this done. Susan.
Thank you, John Luke. In the Sun local news, Golden Gloves recognized for tourism impact. Lowell Sun Charity's president, Kevin Cullen, is seen with Revolutionary Valley Regional Tourism Council Executive Director Brian Badbury. In December 2025, Sports Destination Management, a publication for sports event planners and tournament directors nationwide, announced Lowell's Golden Gloves as one of its 2025 Champions of Economic Impact in Sports Tourism. Sports Destination Management, a publication for sports event planners and tournament directors nationwide, recently announced its 2025 Champions of Economic Impact in Sports Tourism. Among this year's honorees is the New England Golden Gloves Tournament, hosted in Lowell every year. The New England Golden Gloves delivers significant economic value to the region, according to an economic impact report by the Revolutionary Valley Regional Tourism Council. The 2025 tournament generated an estimated $2.4 million for the area economy, supported by 3,330 lodging room nights and substantial spending at area restaurants, shops, and attractions. This award highlights the cooperation between the City of Lowell, Lowell Sun Charities, the Lowell Memorial Auditorium, and Bob Russo, Executive Director of New England Golden Gloves, all working alongside the Revolutionary Valley RTC to support an event that has shaped Lowell's sports and cultural identity for nearly eight decades. For generations, the Golden Gloves has brought athletes, families, and fans into Lowell, filling our hotels and energizing our downtown. Revolutionary Valley Executive Director Brian Bradbury said, "This recognition affirms the event's lasting and consistent impact and the strength of the partnerships that make it possible." The tournament opens at Lowell Memorial Auditorium at 7:30 p.m. Thursday, January 8, and runs Thursdays through March 5 at 50 E Merrimack Street. Fight cards are subject to change. Ticket starts at $21.75. For more information, visit lowellgoldengloves.com. High flu activity. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health reports very high and rising levels of influenza activity statewide as the Commonwealth moves through peak flu season. Thousands of residents have become ill, forcing them to miss work, school, and other activities. Many are experiencing serious complications, leading to increased visits to urgent care centers and emergency departments, and high levels of hospitalization. This is a moment for clarity, urgency, and action, Public Health Commissioner Dr. Robbie Goldstein said. These viruses are serious, dangerous, and life-threatening. We are seeing children who are seriously ill, families grieving devastating losses, and hospitals under capacity strain. There is a simple, effective, and available way to address these concerns: vaccines. They can prevent serious illness and hospitalization, and they save lives. If you have not yet been vaccinated against flu or COVID-19 this season, now is the time. It is not too late. Choosing vaccination is choosing to protect yourself, your family, your friends, your colleagues, and your community. Winter break at the YMCA in Tewksbury. The Greater Lowell YMCA offers week-long recreation camps over February and April school vacations for children ages 5 to 13 at the Tewksbury Recreation Center at 286 Livingston Street. The YMCA will offer a recreation camp Monday, February 16 to Friday, February 20, and Monday, April 20 to Friday, April 24. The camps will be from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. daily. There is a 2-day minimum required for registration, but families may sign up for 2, 3, 4, or 5-day packages. There will be a variety of daily activities, including games, sports, arts, and crafts. Weather permitting, there may be outdoor activities, so campers should be equipped with appropriate outdoor clothing during their selected camp dates. Residents of Tewksbury do not need to be YMCA members to register for these programs. Registration is open. For more information, visit Tewksbury Programs at LowellYMCA.org. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. Former Methuen City Councilor Michael Condon dies at 70. Michael Condon passed away last week, leaving behind a legacy of service and everlasting memories. Condon, who died at age 70 on December 30, had a longtime connection to Salisbury and often visited his father, who had a home at the beach as a young person, his sister Kelly Armstrong said. Condon lived in Methuen for many years, but eventually purchased property in Salisbury in the mid 2000s as a vacation home with his late wife, Leon Condon. Eventually, he transitioned to living in town full-time, Armstrong said. While living in Methuen, Condon served as a city councilor, Greater Lawrence Technical School Committee member, and as a member of the Methuen Exchange Club. After working in the hospitality industry in Methuen for many years, he began working as a chef at Capri Seaside Italian Kitchen and Pizzeria as the roundhouse manager at the historic Salisbury Beach Carousel. He was also a member of the Salisbury Beach Partnership. Armstrong said her brother enjoyed being part of the betterment of the town. Michael loved Salisbury Beach. He loved helping restore Salisbury. That was a big part of him, especially the carousel, he said. Michael Condon and Leanne Condon were also an integral part of bringing the popular Sea Festival of Trees to Salisbury. Kathy Elio, director of the Atlantic Hospitality Group, which operates the Blue Ocean Event Center, where the Sea Festival of Trees is held, said the pair previously hosted the Methuen Festival of Trees at their restaurant, the Red Tavern, and approached Atlantic Hospitality with the idea of bringing the festival to Salisbury in 2013. The couple was heavily involved in the planning of the festival each year, watching it grow into an event that now brings up to 20,000 people each holiday season. From the earliest days of the Sea Festival of Trees, Mike and Leanne were deeply involved as committee members, helping to guide and promote the event year after year, Elio said. They volunteered their time during the festival and consistently contributed their own creatively decorated trees. That was creatively, whatever. Both were strong advocates for the Sea Festival of Trees and for the broader revitalization of Salisbury Beach. Mike was largely respected for his generosity, positive spirit, and steadfast commitment to the success of the beach and the community. Paul Desco, too, operator of the Salisbury Beach Carousel and a friend of Condon, said his loss will be felt heavily in the community, specifically at Salisbury Beach. He was like an ever-ready bunny, running around this beach doing whatever he could for the betterment of the beach, the guests, the merchants, and just everybody, Desco, too, said. Gene Rockton at Salisbury Parks and Recreation Administrator said Condon was quick to lend a helping hand. He was just that kind of person who always showed up. He always asked what you needed, what time you needed it, she said. Rocco Tenez praised Condon's generosity and willingness to help whenever necessary. He always used to say to me, anything for the kids, anything for the kids, anything you need. He was just a really kind and community-oriented man, she said. Similarly, Salisbury Selectman Michael Colburn said Condon was committed to creating a positive atmosphere in town. He was always a big supporter of the carousel, a big supporter of the bands every week. He had a strong passion to help Salisbury be a part of Salisbury, he said. A celebration of Condon's life will be held Sunday from 2 to 6 p.m. at Seaglass Restaurant, 4 Oceanfront, North Salisbury. Susan.
Thank you, John Luke. Back to the Sun, flu season, devastating losses. Bay State reports 3 pediatric flu deaths and 29 among adults. Boston Herald. 3 kids in the Bay State have died from the flu in recent weeks as influenza cases spike, according to health officials who are pleading with residents to get vaccinated. The flu has already been tied to the deaths of 3 pediatric patients in Massachusetts, the Department of Public Health reported on Monday. Also, 29 adult influenza deaths have been reported so far this season. Many residents are experiencing serious complications, leading to increased visits to urgent care centers and emergency departments and high levels of hospitalization. With COVID-19 and RSV rates remain low, cases of both illnesses are beginning to rise. DPH is reviewing 2 possible COVID-19 associated deaths and 1 RSV associated death in individuals under 18 years old. This is a moment for clarity, urgency, and action, Public Health Commissioner Robbie Goldstein said in a statement. These viruses are serious, dangerous, and life-threatening. We are seeing children who are seriously ill, families grieving devastating losses, and hospitals under capacity strain. There is a simple, effective, and available way to address these concerns, vaccines. Goldstein added, they can prevent serious illness and hospitalization, and they save lives. If you have not yet been vaccinated against flu or COVID-19 this season, now is the time. It is not too late. Choosing vaccination is choosing to protect yourself, your family, your friends, your colleagues, and your community. Hospitals across Massachusetts are continuing to see high numbers of patients seeking care for respiratory illnesses. Each day last week, there were nearly 9,000 emergency department visits statewide, with about 25% of those related to acute respiratory illness, including flu, COVID-19, and RSV. Some regions in the state reported challenging hospital capacity levels exceeding 90% in medical surgical units, largely related to flu. DPH urges everyone 6 months plus to stay up to date on flu and COVID-19 vaccinations. These annual shots can be given at the same visit and are available from local boards of health, community health centers, pharmacies, and many healthcare providers. Vaccination is especially important for people at higher risk of severe disease, including adults aged 65 years and older. Children between 6 months and 2 years, people with chronic respiratory conditions or heart disease, individuals who are immunocompromised, and people who are pregnant. Vaccination also helps protect family members, coworkers, and others in the community who may be more vulnerable to serious illness. For RSV, one-time immunization is recommended for adults 75+. Those aged 50 to 74 who have conditions that put them at increased risk, and people who are pregnant. For infants and children, parents should talk with their child's health care provider about RSV immunization. It's recommended that infants younger than 8 months be immunized if the birth parent did not receive the RSV shot during pregnancy. Children between 8 and 19 months who are at increased risk because of certain pulmonary or immune system disorders should be immunized. In Massachusetts, vaccines are covered by insurance and are available at no cost for almost all adults. All vaccines for individuals younger than 18 are supplied free of charge to healthcare providers through the state's Universal Childhood Immunization Program. For those who begin to experience flu symptoms, high fever, chills, muscle aches, headache, extreme fatigue, cough, sore throat, and congestion, antiviral medications such as Tamiflu are available by prescription. When started early, these medications can significantly reduce the severity of illness. Parents are encouraged to seek medical advice if they or their children develop flu-like symptoms. Back to you, Jean-Luc.
Thank you, Susan. It's good for the papers to be reminding us of the importance of immunizations. Okay, later stuff. Boy Scouts to collect Christmas trees, Salem. Troop 409 will be collecting Christmas trees for disposal at no cost to town people. However, donations are encouraged to help defray the cost of scout activities throughout the year. Pickup will begin at 8 a.m. on January 10 and is only available to Salem residents. To sign up for pickup, visit, this is an impossible URL, so I'm going to give you the beginning part, which is forms.gle/a bunch of random characters. So hopefully if you go to forms.gle, it will help you with the rest. You can also just call for questions to, email for questions to troop409salemnh@gmail.com. Crying in the Wilderness, an asylum seeker's journey in detention. Derry, the Etz Haman Synagogue presents Crying in the Wilderness with Becky Field, a photographer who has been capturing the lives of immigrants since 2012. Her work will be presented on January 8th at the synagogue. 1-1/1 Hood Road. In 2001, Field met Aunt Tony, an African asylum seeker who was tracked with an ankle monitor and was detained under house arrest. Every week for almost 2 years, Field photographed his experiences during his detention. She will show photographs of her work with Antoni, talk about their times together and his current status, and share a video of Antoni telling his story. Notice of redistricting in Salem. Town Salem residents are advised that new voting districts and polling locations will take effect beginning with the March 2026 town meeting election. These changes were approved by voters at the March 2025 town meeting and are intended to improve accessibility, reduce overcrowding, and better accommodate Salem's growing population. As part of the approved redistricting plan, the town will reduce the number of polling locations from 5 to 4. The updated polling locations will include the Woodbury Middle School, the North Salem School, the Fisk School, and the Barron School. Under the new plan, the Woodbury Middle School will replace the Senior Center as a central polling location. Many voters who previously voted at the Senior Center will not vote at Woodbury. Additionally, the Soul School polling location will be eliminated, and voters who previously voted there will be distributed to Woodbury, Barron, and Fisk. Said Woodbury Middle School was chosen for its large capacity, improved handicap accessibility, and more adequate parking, allowing for better overall voting experience. Postcards will be mailed to residents prior to the March 2026 election to notify voters of their assigned polling location. I guess I can feel happy that I can walk to mine. Okay, Valentine's Day with animals. Salem. The Salem Animal Rescue League is kicking off 2026 in style with a positively perfect Valentine's Day weekend raffle. The winner will make Valentine's Day memories to last a lifetime, and every ticket purchase helps homeless animals. The grand prize is a special holiday winter winefest package for two at the luxurious Wentworth by the Sea Resort in Portsmouth. It includes a two-night stay, February 13 and 14, and two tickets to each of the festival's signature events, including wine tasting and a fine dining dinner experience and brunch. Raffle tickets are available for $25 each or $5 for $100. They can be purchased at sarlnh.org/events. Also, I guess that's for Salem. Never mind. S-A-R-L-N-H. Individuals must be at least 21 years old to enter. The winner will be drawn on February 2nd. All proceeds to benefit the animals at SARL. Susan.
Thank you, John Luke. And this is on transportation. Beacon Hill hears driving reduction bill. Senator concerned with subtle bias against workers in rural communities. Boston Herald. A bill is advancing through the Massachusetts State House that would seek to reduce the amount of miles residents travel in their personal vehicles in order to meet state climate mandates. An act aligning the Commonwealth's transportation plan with its mandates and goals for reducing emissions and vehicle miles traveled. S-2246 was filed by State Senator Cynthia Stone Cream and is based on existing laws and regulations in Colorado and Minnesota and is meant to bring Massachusetts in line with its climate mandates. The bill would also require MassDOT to set goals for reducing the number of statewide driving miles, which would be considered when EEA sets greenhouse gas emissions limits and sublimits, a summary of the legislation says. Sponsors and supporters of the bill alike argue the legislation is needed due to the fact that the transportation sector accounts for the greatest share of emissions in Massachusetts. The sector is the largest source of emissions in the Commonwealth, accounting for roughly 40% of overall carbon pollution, said Casey Bowers of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. While testifying in support of the bill before the Joint Committee on Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy, Kevin Shannon, an analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists, also testified in support. saying it would fill a necessary gap between our climate goals and plans and the transportation plans the state makes every year. He also argues the legislation will improve public health across Massachusetts. Our recent research and that same report has shown that across the country, this kind of transition could save over $100 billion in public health costs from improved air quality alone. And that doesn't even account for the reduced pedestrian fatalities and the increased benefits of public transportation, Shannon said. But State Senator and Committee Chair Michael Barrett expressed concern about how limiting statewide personal vehicle miles would affect those in rural parts of the state. I do worry about an unintended and subtle bias against rural Massachusetts, said Barrett. Why would we want to start to pressure Massachusetts to reduce all miles traveled, polluting and non-polluting alike? Does raise the question of what someone is to do in a place when one has to travel a long distance to a construction job or any other place of employment, Barrett said. Seth Gadbois, a clean transportation attorney at the Conservation Law Foundation, argued that providing more public transit throughout the state and in rural areas will incentivize people to drive less. This is not also about going after drivers who need or just want to drive, said Shannon. There have been enough people across demographics, including and especially in rural areas, who are saying we need and want ways to get around. And by providing those people the means and options to get around, we believe that is what will get the path towards meeting these targets. No specific figure was listed in the bill for how many driving miles per person will be reduced, but it does task the Transportation Secretary with establishing the official vehicle travel reduction goal for the year 2030 and for every fifth year thereafter. It would also establish a 15-member Intergovernmental Coordinating Council to find ways to make public transportation more accessible for residents and possibly even incentivize the use of public transit. The bill was reported favorably by the Joint Committee on Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy in a 4-1 vote in November and has been referred to the Senate Ways and Means Committee. Not covered by the bill, an expense account that pays lawmakers for travel to and from the State House. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, Massachusetts lawmakers living within 50 miles of the State House receive a $17,043 office expense stipend that can be used for travel expenses, while lawmakers living more than 50 miles from the State House receive a $22,723 stipend for travel. That's on top of a base salary of $82,044 for all state lawmakers, up over 11% from the 2024 base pay. Back to you, John Luke.
Thank you, Susan. And if you're concerned about these kind of pollution things, you should check out the movement to stop private jet expansion, especially at Cancer Air Force Base. That is the most polluting form of transportation there is, and it benefits so few. Okay, back to what's really published. Methuen learned to play the ukulele in Methuen. This is random things to do. Thursday, January 9, Methuen Thrift Shop open. Monday through Thursday, shop from a wonderful selection of clothing, shoes, household goods and more, all at unbeatable prices. 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., Methuen Senior Activity Center, 77 Lowell Street. Information at 978-983-8825. North Andover, wood carving, Thursdays. A great social group welcoming all levels of carvers, 9 to 11:30 a.m. at the North Andover Senior Center, 481 Sutton Street. Call for space availability. 978-688-9560. And there's a thing from www northandovermaallonework.gov. Andover, Discover Your Past Genealogy Club, meets the second Thursday of every month, 9:30 to 11 a.m., Memorial Hall Library, 2 North Main Street. Register at 978-623-8400, or a nice short URL of www.mhl.org. Haverhill, Bilingual Storytime, ages 2 through 6, Thursdays. Join Moria from Family Connections with stories, songs, and fun in English and Spanish. This playful story time supports early language learning and celebrates both languages through books, music, and age-appropriate activities. This is from 10 to 11 a.m. at the Haverhill Public Library at 99 Main Street. You can register at 978-373-1586 or at www.haverhillpl.org. Methuen, learn to play the ukulele, 10 a.m. through noon, Methuen Senior Activity Center, 77 Lowell Street. Registration required, 978-983-8825. Questions, Aura, at phone number 978-390-1640, or Anne-Marie at 336-626-2181. Methuen, new parent meetup. Join with your little ones for a relaxed weekly meetup designed for parents and caregivers of youngsters up to 18 months old. Connect with others in the community, share experiences, and build your support network in a friendly, welcoming space. 10 to 11:30 a.m., Nevins Library, 305 Broadway. Register 978-686-4080. www.nevinslibrary.org. North Andover, Mornings at the Library for All Abilities, Adults. This month, participants will complete building challenges with Legos, planks, and magnet tiles. 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. at the Stevens Memorial Library, 345 Main Street. Register at 978-688-9505. www.stevensmemoriallibrary.org. Groveland, Mahjong, new to the game? Come learn, already play, come join the fun. This is 11 a.m., Council on Aging, Town Hall, 1830 Main Street. To RSVP at 978-372-1101. Or www.grovelandma.com. And Mahjong is not just a solitaire thing you see on the computers. This is like rummy on steroids with really pretty tiles. It's pretty interesting. Okay. Groveland Men's Group. Join for a relaxed drop-in gathering designed for camaraderie, storytelling, and shared interests. 1:30 p.m., Council on Aging, Town Hall, 183 Main Street. RSVP 978-372-1101. Info at www.grovelandma.com. Andover, Dungeons and Dragons for Teens. Join for tabletop role-playing. No experience necessary. 3:30 to 4:45 p.m. at Memorial Hall Library, 2 North Main Street. For info, 978-623-8400 or www.mhl.org. Probably worth going to their website in general. Apparently there's a lot going on there. So, Andover, Next Chapter Book Club, a book club for adults with intellectual or developmental disabilities. Join to enjoy good stories and fun conversations. 4 to 5 p.m. Memorial Hall Library, 2 North Main Street. Register 978-623-8400. www.mhl.org. Haverhill, Teen Game Zone, age 11 through 18. Join to show off your skills in games on the Nintendo Switch. 4 to 5 p.m., Haverhill Public Library, 99 Main Street. Info, 978-373-1586. Lost my place. Methuen, read to Murphy the dog, age 5 through 18. Read to a dog gives kids a chance to practice their reading skills with a friendly, non-judgmental audience. A great setting for anxious readers. 4 to 5 p.m. by appointment at the Nevins Library, 305 Broadway. Register 978-686-4080. www.nevinslibraryallineword.org. Methuen Teen Anime Club, age 13 through 18. If you are a fan of anime or just curious about it, this is the club for you. Come to watch and discuss your favorite anime, draw manga, or just hang out. This is 4 to 5:30 p.m., Nevins Library, 305 Broadway. Register 978-686-4080. www.nevinslibrary.org. Probably another good place to check out the website. A lot of stuff going on there. So, okay, North Andover Kids Nonfiction Book Club. Meet to discuss Massachusetts by Kate Conley, 4 to 4:45 p.m. Stevens Memorial Library, 345 Main Street. Register 978-688-9505. stevensmemlib.org. Haverhill Game Night. Thursdays, strategy games, abstract games, filler games, complex and non-complex alike. Come and try out whatever you like. Feel free to bring your own games. All experience levels are welcome. 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. Haverhill Public Library, 99 Main Street. Info at 978-373-1586, www.haverhillpl.org. Methuen, speed dating, ages 4 to 55. Great conversation, good vibes, and maybe even a spark are awaiting you. 6 p.m., Pickers Greenhouse, 18 Ayers Village Road. Cost is $35 per person. And info at an impossible URL. Methuen, LGBTQ plus book discussion group. January's book is The Loves of My Life, a Sex Memoir by Edmund White, 6:30 through 8:30 p.m. at Nevins Library, 305 Broadway, 978-686-4080, www.nivenslibrary.org. Andover Writers Group meets on the second Thursday of the month, 7 to 8:45 p.m., Memorial Hall Library, 2 North Main Street, 978-623-8400, www.mhl.org. Methuen, Thursday Evening Book Discussion Group. January's book is Burgess Boys by Elizabeth Strout, 7 to 9 p.m., Nevins Library, 305 Broadway, 978-686-4080, www.nevinslibrary.org. Friday, January 9th, Haverhill Eggs and Issues. A guest speaker will be State Rep. Andy X. Vargas, 8:30 to 9:30 a.m., Hampton Inn by Hilton, 106 Bank Road, $15 for chamber members and $25 for non. If you're into a register, www.haverhillchamber.com. Hey, Methuen, thrift shop open Friday. Shop from a wonderful selection of stuff at unbeatable prices, 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Methuen Senior Center at 2077 Lowell Street. I think that was a repeat. North Andover Cuddles, Fryberry, on Friday. Trace cut, sew, stuff, dress, and paint dolls and bears for local charities. 9 to 11 a.m., North Andover Senior Center, 481 Sutton Street. Register at 978-688-9560 or www.northandoverma.gov. Methuen Books and Bubbles, ages 0 to 18 months. This language enrichment program features fun songs and finger play stories and everybody's favorite final, Bubbles. 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. at Nevins Public Library, 305 Broadway. Register 978-686-4080, www.nevinslibrary.org. Andover Photo Connection. Join in this group of photo enthusiasts to share photography techniques, interests, and experiences. 10 a.m., the Robb Center, 30 Whittier Court, info 978-623-8320, www.andoverma.gov/elder-services. Well, that's all we have time for today, and it looks like there's a lot more going on. It's interesting. Okay. Thank you for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about a radio reading service, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Susan and John Luke. Thanks for listening and Happy New Year. Goodbye.